Welcome to The Wheel. I'm Rebecca Chenalu, your local voice in the international movement to bring death out of the closet. I'm very happy to have you here to join the conversation as we consider the mysteries of living, dying, preparing for death, loving, grieving, and honoring our dead. This show is about creating community. That's the reason I do this. So I also invite you to participate by sharing your input on our Facebook page at The Wheel Mysteries. Go ahead and pull it up right now. I've got some things on there that might be of interest. But before we get started, let's thank some of the underwriters who make this show possible. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Dallmeyer Insurance Agency, an independent agent and retail broker since 1948. Dallmeyer Insurance provides a range of coverage options from home and auto insurance to farm and ranch coverage. You can reach Dallmeyer Insurance in Chico at 342-6421 and in Oroville at 533-3424 or at chicoinsurance.com. Thank you to our underwriters. Welcome back to this episode of The Wheel. Preparing for the October episode of The Wheel had me thinking about Halloween and ghosts and Day of the Dead, but I had tonight's show come up for me in a liminal moment, like a message. You know, those early a.m. hours when you're not ready to be awake, but you also are not asleep, around 4 or 4:30 a.m. When my husband realizes I'm awake, he likes to quote the Rumi poem that says, "The morning breeze has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep." So I've learned to try to listen for the secrets. And it was in a moment like this that it hit me that this show would be about fear, about the fear of death. And I knew in that moment that I would ask to feature Dr. John Schmidt. And also an image of a post-it note written by my friend Alan Bevan, who died on Flight 93, popped into my mind. A post-it note they found at his desk at work that said simply, "Fear? Who cares?" ? A striking epitaph considering his death, I think. So this began a process of looking at the fear of death from many different angles, and there is much that could be said. In this episode, we'll be hearing from local physician Dr. John Schmidt, who's been living with a life-limiting illness for 7 years and who's now near the end of his time living intimately with death. We'll have the opportunity to reflect on some of the big questions that have come to him. And as these things go, you'll see that the show has evolved into an exploration not so much about fear, but about the serenity that is possible when we engage with death instead of denying it. We'll also be mixing in a little music from a musician who died in the month of October. And as usual, we'll have an exit tip for your exit plan and a few announcements of death-friendly events you might want to consider attending. We hope you'll plan to stay with us the whole show, but if you can't, the show will be archived at kzfr.org for about 2 weeks, and I also try to post a version of the show on Facebook and SoundCloud. Let's dive in and begin by listening to the first segment of my interview with Dr. John Schmidt.
I Hi, my name is John Schmidt. I'm 75 years old. I've been a doctor for 50 years this year. I was amazed. Anyway, I practiced medicine until 7 years ago in Orland, at other points up in Washington. And until 7 years ago when I got multiple myeloma and became too fatigued and weak to continue. Multiple myeloma is a bone marrow blood cancer, cancer of the plasma cells, which are the immune cells in your body. There's no way to cure this cancer at this time. I was told initially that I had a prognosis of 3 to 5 years with the treatments that were available at that time. And so I initially had to deal with that reality. I had a bone marrow transplant. I've been on continuous medications that caused changes, chemo brain and all kinds of side effects. About a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I told my doctor I just can't go on with this any longer. And he said, well, we have one new treatment. It's, it's a treatment that has antibodies against your cancer. And it worked well. The side effects went away. The cancer came under control. And he said it would work about a year and a half. And he was exactly right. And when it quit working, about 6 months ago, I quit treatment, and I was in a lot of pain starting in July 1st. Fortunately, this condition is sensitive to radiation therapy, and I've had 6 treatments of radiation. I've been living with a pain level out of 10 of about 7, and now I'm down to a 2 or 3 again, so I feel very fortunate. Initially, I was quite afraid. I had a friend who had been a patient of mine and who had multiple myeloma and died from the initial treatment to try to prepare a person for a transplant. He had died in about 3.5-4 months after the diagnosis was made. And so I initially assumed that that was probably going to be my fate too. And so I was quite anxious and felt very uncomfortable about that whole thing, but I recognize that, you know, there's more to me than my physical body, and I'm needed to engage with that. So initially, I went through a process of trying to become friends with death. And so I listened to people who've had near-death experiences. I had had an experience of similar at one point where I had entered a white light experience similar to people who've had near-death. I'd also almost died when I was 16 years old from an infection in my nose, and nobody told me I was dying, but if it was supposed to be, it didn't seem like it was a bad thing. So I had listened to a lot of mystics, I'd listened to a lot of people who had been through this, and examined the spiritual quadrant. I see a person as 4 quadrants: physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. Anyway, fear of dying, after about 6 months after my diagnosis and I was stable, I'd kind of come to the conclusion that everybody dies and that I wasn't afraid of dying. At that point, the fear had gone. But what hadn't gone is the sadness of leaving. It's a different state. You know, we all die, but it's the sadness I have to leave and those who are here, I won't be with them anymore. I won't be with the life all around me anymore, or the earth, or it'll be a different state, and that's okay. But, you know, you do have to grieve that.
I'm curious more about that turning point for you when you realized that you weren't afraid of death. You went from a place of being afraid to not being afraid, and you talked about it a little bit in terms of the spiritual quadrant. How does that make sense in relation to what you've just said?
Well, my relationship to a spiritual self is a direct one. My relationship to this essence, this higher power, this presence, is a result of, and it has become much deeper after I was aware that my body probably wasn't going to be around. But it has been one of having almost a conversation with this essence. But it's not for I'm not asking for a certain outcome. I'm asking for the ability to be given a direction of a question. It's almost like, you know, well, and I wait for the presence to tell me what to do next. It's turning the ability to accept what is really with trust. It starts with a leap of faith over in the past, and the more I let go of thinking that a certain outcome was the right one, and living with fear that if it didn't happen, then that would be bad. Death is inevitable. My faith I really call it trust now. My experience says that when I listen to this part of self and to all the other parts of myself, to when I listen to my physical self and my emotional self and my intellectual self, and they're all working together, then I live with serenity. I live with what is. Whatever's happening today is the way it's supposed to be.
I'm going to pause there in the interview to reflect on a few things about what John is saying, and I invite you to reflect right along with me. John talks about when he got his diagnosis, how he was afraid, particularly since he'd had a friend who had died of the same condition in 3 or 4 months. Fear is a natural reaction. It's a survival instinct. And there's plenty written about how our amygdala in our brain sets off the alarm and shuts down the thinking part of our brain when we're threatened with annihilation. So there's no need to blame ourselves for being afraid. It's a natural reaction. But John turned his awareness and attention away from his fear to some experiences in his past that helped to calm him. He had had what he calls a white light experience. He had had an experience when he was 16 where he realized he was close to death and also realized that it didn't seem that bad. The really cool thing is that many of us have had these kinds of experiences. I mean, take a moment now and think about your own life. You may not have had a white light experience, but many of us have experiences, particularly in our childhood, but it can happen at any time, where we have a moment, like a moment of oneness with nature that blows us away and puts us in touch with something bigger than ourselves. Or we receive a message from a loved one who has already died, and it can't be explained, but we know it's true. And it comforts us. Or there's a moment when we felt a supreme peacefulness that passed all understanding. Or in a life-threatening moment, we were suddenly overcome by a loving presence that assures us that everything is all right. We read about these experiences. For ourselves, they're often private and deeply personal. And we might not talk about them much. But when we're confronted with fear, we have the ability to shift our focus to these experiences we've had, and it can help calm the panic. Like John, we can also read the writings of mystics through the ages and of many traditions who describe these experiences. I know that one of these people that John has leaned on in his process is Richard Rohr, a Franciscan friar, a modern Christian mystic, and an author. I'm going to read a short excerpt of his here, and you can find more at cac.org, which is the website for the Center for Action and Contemplation. Great website. The guy is a Christian, so there is a mention of God, and if that word doesn't work for you, just insert whatever word or metaphor works better. He writes, "Whenever we are fearing death, whether physical death or the loss of some egoic attachment, we're in our false self at that moment. The false self is not really bad or evil, but just inadequate to the big questions of love, death, suffering, God, or infinity. God allows and uses all our diversionary tactics to get us to move towards our full and final destination, which is divine union, and thus wholeness. That is how perfect and patient divine love is. Nothing is wasted. Even in our mistakes are the raw material to turn us back into love. So do not be afraid. Death to false self and the end of human life is simply a return to our ground of being, to God, to love. Life doesn't truly end. It simply changes form and continues evolving into ever new shapes and beauty. I love this metaphor that death doesn't really end life. And this description of the false self, and it made me think of the quote on Alan's sticky note. Fear, who cares? Now, when I first saw this quote, almost 20 years ago, it seemed defiant and almost cavalier. I'll look the fear of death in the face and say, who cares? And I saw him using that affirmation on Flight 93. But the secret that the morning breeze told me is that this phrase can read very differently. Fear, who cares? What self? What who is fearing? Who is caring about whether this is good or bad? Who's doing the judging? What part of us is afraid of dying? The physical, the emotional, the intellectual self, it seems these will cease to be, and that scares us. But what about that spiritual quadrant, that experience many of us have had that transcends our smaller sense of self? Do you have a sense of that? Do you have a way to engage with that presence? And can you learn to trust it, whatever that is for you? My friend Alan Bevan had a very established yoga practice, and I feel certain now that he also understood the phrase in this way. Thank you, morning breeze. All right. Let's hear more about John's process, in particular, how things have played out with his family. Here we go.
When my pelvis broke in July 1st, I was up there. I was supposed to be up there for 2 weeks with my grandsons and having fun with in our cabin. And as it turned out, after 1 week, I couldn't do that anymore. But that was it was what was supposed to happen. Because then it kind of, my whole family became quite aware that my situation is getting fairly dire. I'm nearing the end of life because there's no further treatments that I can take that have been shown to be of value at this point.
You've mentioned your family and friends, and yes. I know that you've been talking to family and friends about your ideas about dying for some time now, and I wonder what fears you've noticed in others as you talk about this stuff, or their comfort level or not comfort level. How have you dealt with that?
Well, it's kind of different. My experience with family specifically has been they'd rather remain in denial and pretend like I'm going to live longer. Every time I say, well, finally this year, my doctor in San Francisco said, you know, John, if this stuff quits working, you probably got 6 months to live. He's been pretty dang right on every time. So I'm anticipating somewhere here in the next 6 months that I'll probably not be here anymore. But my wife had to hear that from the doctor. If I told her that it was that way, well, no, are you sure? You know, I don't look that bad. I don't look like I'm a person that's dying. I've not lost weight. This cancer is kind of a weird one in that way. And so I can see why it's really hard to say, well, Dad says he's going to die in 6 months. I'm not sure about that. So they're not accepting of that. I have a large group of friends who are doctors who all have cancer. And their experience is exactly the same. Members of their family don't see them as near death as they experience it internally. So we have been able to talk because they're aware of their prognosis. They're aware that the reality is that this is the way it is. And of course, we can, as the cancer comes under control, it's easy to go back into, well, maybe I've got more time than I thought. The gratitude was that, you know, somebody could listen to them and get it. That is hard for people who don't want to lose you as part of their life to think that you're going to be gone. And yet you need that around you to express that process, to really come to accept this. It's just as an okay outcome.
That was just a small snippet of the interview, but it's packed with some important information about how to be with people who are dealing with life-limiting illness. This is something that a lot of us have to deal with, and it's very tricky. And John has some words of wisdom for us. John mentions how his family has been in denial. His wife doesn't want to believe he's nearing the end of his life, and she doesn't believe it until the doctor tells her it is so. And this fear of losing someone we love is also natural. Wanting to deny that it's happening is a normal response. I'm sure that many of you listeners, as you have watched loved ones decline, have denied it, grasping at the hope that somehow this isn't really happening. John also talks about his doctor friends who also have cancer and are experiencing the same thing. And he says, families don't see it in the same way we are experiencing it internally. And John expresses how grateful they all are that they have each other, that they have someone who can listen and who can talk about death. Because as John says, you need this to accept that death is an okay outcome. I see this all the time at the cancer center where I work. Of course, everyone wants to be one of the rare few who miraculously recovers from a terminal diagnosis. And I always encourage people to make that the plan A, to be one of those people, if possible. But since in the vast majority of those cases, death will come, there is wisdom in tenderly and courageously exploring what that will mean and how you will deal with it as a plan B. It can be a huge relief to a patient to realize that they can talk about their dying. There will be big feelings, but that is normal too. You will learn that you can weather those big feelings. You'll be addressing the elephant in the room. You'll learn how to cope with it. So I'll repeat what John said, that when dealing with life-limiting illness, there's great value in being with others who can talk about death. And as we'll hear from John in a minute, having a life-limiting illness and having this time to live with death, even as he pursued every treatment option, has changed his life dramatically in amazing ways. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But for now, I'd like to take a little musical break by our musician who died in October, because this stuff can get kind of heavy. Here we go.
Just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning, Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all. it's nothing at all.
You know, I'm not really a Lou Reed fan. I mean, some songs, but I wasn't a big fan. And I kind of feel like the ghost of Lou Reed pushed to get on this show. And it happened because of this beautiful quote that popped up from his brilliant wife and widow, Laurie Anderson. Writing about his final moments, Laurie said, "I have never seen an expression as full of wonder as Lou's as he died. His hands were doing the water flowing 21 form of Tai Chi. His eyes were wide open. I was holding in my arms the person I loved the most in the world and talking to him as he died. His heart stopped. He wasn't afraid. I had gotten to walk with him to the end of the world. Life, so beautiful, painful, and dazzling, does not get better than that. And death? I believe that the purpose of death is the release of love." Oh, thank you, Lori. And thank you, Lou. Lou Reed died October 27, 2013. He was 71 years old. Did you know that Lou Reed was so into Tai Chi? As Laurie says, he turned to that practice as he died. There are some great YouTube videos of him doing Tai Chi if you want to check it out. And he's just so centered, so powerful. Listen, friends, if Lou Reed can die a peaceful, conscious death, it's got to be possible for all of us. Okay, so for now, before diving into our next segment of the interview, it is time to once again thank our underwriters who make my show possible, who make this show possible. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Baker's Birkenstock, open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for in-store shopping. Face mask, social distancing, and sanitized hands are required. There's also curbside pickup available by calling either their Chico or Paradise locations. Details on Facebook at birkenstockchico.com or at 345-4880. And by Members First Credit Union, created by the community for the community. Members First is a member-owned, not-for-profit financial institution providing checking, savings, loans, and credit cards to residents of Butte, Glen, Shasta, and Tehama counties. For more information, visit m1cu.org. Thank you, underwriters. I love Members First. That's my credit union. Alrighty. If you're just joining us, we're listening to my interview with Dr. John Schmidt, a family physician from Orland who has lived for 7 years with multiple myeloma, an incurable cancer, and who is now nearing the end of his life. In this section, we'll hear more about how John has used art to gain new insights. Insights that are really important for all of us, since ultimately, friends, we all have a terminal diagnosis in that we all will eventually die. Okay, here we go.
I really have appreciated how you've had this group of friends, doctors, that you could talk to honestly about death, And I wonder, as a medical doctor and hanging out with medical doctors with cancer, you know, do you have any thoughts about the physiology of dying that helps you deal with the fear of dying or not?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by physiology. It is still kind of a mystery. There's many different syndromes that lead to death. It's when the essence of life leaves you, is what it is. That's when you die. The energy of life leaves. I did an art series initially on this when I first got the diagnosis, and I had to go through the process. And so, some of my paintings in that was about what makes us alive, what makes us not alive. What happens to that life energy when you die? Well, does it go? It goes. It seems to just go away in a breath. That's part of the relationship I have now with my life energy. I'm aware of my life energy in all aspects of the self. One of the things that because I've had so much time, I was supposed to be dead in 3 years, and I'm now out here 7 years. I've had time to go back through this process. So one of the first things I did was, you know, this art series about re-engaging with the spiritual side, with re-engaging with my soul, I called it initially. My first painting series was a series about, it's a transition from an assumed safety place by living a healthy life to the recognition that my health was in danger, my life energy was in danger from this diagnosis of cancer. And so I went through the process of being aware that the life energy, physical life energy, was possibly going to be not around. And so part of the series that I did initially was trying to understand life energy. And then re-engaging with soul energy was the second part of that art series for me. And the awareness that I could have a conversation, or I could have an interaction via my soul and the soul of the universe, or God, or higher power, or something. And when I was able to connect with that, then serenity came. I felt at peace. You know, I went through the process of engaging with trying to understand how this works. My experience with art actually started with an art therapy episode. First thing I did in art therapy was a challenge to my intellectual side. And I did a series of paintings, but Cynthia Schildhauer is an art therapist here, was giving courses, and I went there and she said, well, let's do this and this, and she'd prepare us a little bit, and then we'd do this big painting in a half an hour. And I was blown away because I couldn't see what I was thinking before or feeling before. It allowed me to see it in front of myself. That relationship to self changed because it was on the paper, it was on the canvas, and then I could understand what was going on inside of me much better. It was art therapy was superbly helpful to me. It still is. I'm still interpreting what I do in art as a interaction with self that comes out on canvas. The last I'm in a series right now. I'm going to call it Sunsets because I feel like told me I had 6 months to live, and so I believed him. But it's going to be instead of Sun, S-U-N, it's going to be S-O-N, because I'm a native son of this area here. But the first sunset I did was absolutely not a sunset. It was like this raging sun not wanting to go down. I call it a defiant sunset or an unwilling sunset. So it was a message from myself that I wasn't aware of. Because I thought I was just going to have a series of easy sunsets and that was the end. But it wasn't. So It's just amazing. So for me, art is a message to myself, my whole self, from my soul self.
Did you have an art background before you started using art with Cynthia to explore this stuff?
No.
Yeah. I want listeners to hear that because, as you know, I'm a big proponent of art as a way to find meaning. And you are a very, very good poster child for that, John.
Well, it certainly has been very helpful because then I was going, the next thing I wanted to do was to, what is the nature of a human being? And so I did a series of art about nature, about withdrawal from the culture to know self. And so going into forest, it was a big series I did about the value of nature. And I went through the forest and a whole bunch of areas and see how it lived. How did nature live? There's not right or wrong, good or bad in nature. There just is. And so that's really one of my soulful changes was not seeing events around me as good or bad, right or wrong, but the way things are. And my initial series of painting about when I was given the diagnosis and I had to go, I had a sheltered, I used to use the house as an image of self in relation to earth and to society and all. And that house was very well protected. It had closed doors, but it was seen in a teal color, which I interpreted as maintaining serenity in the midst of chaos. Well, the house I live in now doesn't see the world as chaotic. It sees it as a place it is, an appreciation for it.
It sees it as it is, and there's an appreciation for it. You can hear in John's story his amazement at the way art therapy works to reveal things to him, and how he has learned to use it as a way to engage with his own inherent wisdom. I mean, first the exploration of the life energy and soul energy, then onto the forests to better understand nature and how in nature things like death are not good or bad. It just is. And now the sunset series with its surprising defiance. Each of these series of paintings reveal through symbols and color and metaphors deeper meaning than the intellect was able to grasp on its own. And I call that soul language. And when we experience it, we know we have touched something true and real and powerful. And that's how art works. And that's why ancient shamans and healers and now arts and medicine programs all over the world use art to help people find peace and feel better about whatever it is they're going through. Here in Chico, we have local art therapist Cynthia Schildhauer, who John worked with, and healing artist Christine McShane, and marriage and family therapist and artist Amber Palmer, and I'm sure there are more. We have people in our community who do this work. If you're interested in giving it a try, you don't have to have cancer. Art is healing for all kinds of things. And you don't have to be an artist. As John said, he had never done this kind of thing before. In fact, in my experience, you can be a complete cynic about the whole thing, and you'll probably still get something out of it. It's that good. So, if you are curious about John's paintings, you can check out his book. He did publish a little book, limited edition, called Experiencing Oneness. It has some of his writing in it to explain the pictures as well. And we have it at the Cancer Center Library. That's where I sit, for those of you who don't already know that. I'll also post a few of his paintings at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook. Okay. Let's go to our final segment of the interview with Dr. John Schmidt, a family doctor from Orland who has found serenity while living with a life-limiting illness.
And reason it comes up for me listening to you is that people might be listening and think, well, this experience happened to him, but it can't happen to me. I'm just not in that place. So that's not what I believe. And when you read these books about people approaching the ends of their lives, you learn, and I can tell that you've read those books. What's really, really fascinating, and I think hugely reassuring, is that no matter what walk of life, no matter what job you did in your life, no matter how many kids you have or how much money you have or don't have, we as humans are wired for the kinds of realizations that you've been having. Each in our own way has been shown to lead towards the same thing, which is a growing reassurance that it's okay.
Yes.
A growing understanding of ourselves as part of a greater whole. The gratitude that you describe, the way that judgments fall away and love takes over. These things, no matter who you are or what your walk of life, are possible according to the studies that I've read and the books you've read and your experience. So I assure people that it's a possibility for all of us. I think it does depend on how willing we are to engage with it. And you've been very willing, and you've had the time, thanks to your diagnosis, to engage with it for quite an extended period of time. But even people with less time, it's been shown that these realizations can come in a flash. You know, they can come very late in the game. So,
well, you know, that's what Kubler-Ross, you know, when she was doing those interviews with the people in the hospital, there would become a period of from fear, and they would go into just this quiet acceptance, this accepted a state of acceptance, and they were at peace. And so I've got to live in that place for a long time, but it almost always happens. I think one of the things about getting a cancer and knowing that it's a final diagnosis usually forces you to stop and look at life and what's it all about. And and in my experience, you do have to have a period of anxiety, sadness. In my experience was you go from grief to gratitude in almost all things that you have to let go of. I've become, you know, I wake up with the awareness that I have a day of life, maybe today. So it becomes a day at a time. There's no long-term, oh, years from now I'm going to do this. No, it's living life in the moment, every day, and with gratitude, and with gratitude for those around you and the life around you. Each day becoming more and more aware of the nature of this energy that's all around us, and living in the with presence with it. It's almost like you're out there in your area, and you're going, wow, this is a great, a wonderful place to live. Quit looking at things that aren't as they, quote, should be, and enjoy what is. It's just, it's remarkable. It's amazing. It's, it's like, oh, wow, look at this. Oh, I can go and see this, or I can learn something about this. It's not like, oh, it's all over. It's, well, how can I maximize the moments that I have left and with those around me and people? And that's what happens for me. One of the things in my first series was I wake up without illusion or my delusions about life. The delusions of life, the illusions of life are gone. When you get a diagnosis, it says your time is over, you know. And so that's it's the gift of to know this stuff. And there's just some great people out there who've studied this, or who stop and say, learning to live in the presence of death makes life more valuable. It just is. It's just, you know. That was one of my paintings. It was, at any moment, we go from a life energy to a death energy. Boom, just like that. And it can happen at any age, at any time. And so that was one of the understandings that came to me right off, how the life energy is present and then it's not. And so the gift of life has to be met with gratitude.
Oh, I don't know what happened there, John. I do have the line written down, though, because it's the last line. The gift of life has to be met with gratitude every day. The gift of life has to be met with gratitude every day. So many great lessons in this for all of us. How about stop looking at things that aren't the way they should be and just enjoy what is? It's remarkable. It's amazing. Thank you so, so much, John, for sharing these experiences with us. You know, from working at the Cancer Center, I know that this experience is not unique to John. Finding serenity, being amazed at life, and experiencing deep gratitude in the presence of death are things that those of us who work in oncology and hospice get to see with some regularity. Of course, we also get to see lots of different experiences, and your experiences may be very different from John's too. And there are many stories that are tragic. I mean, particularly at this time of fires and COVID. And sometimes things are so tragic that the only appropriate response is lament. I mean, a terminal diagnosis for a young person, particularly a parent of young kids, it never feels fair. The death of a child, so heart-wrenching. And for these experiences, there will be different metaphors and different realizations along the way. In a quote from the book, Living Fully, Dying Well, and I'm going to mention the title a couple of times, Living Fully, Dying Well, Joan Halifax Roshi confesses that the greatest fear she has is that she's going to fail her death. And she writes about working with someone who said to her, I don't want to be judged on how I die. And this jumped out at me because in my work of encouraging people to be prepared, I don't want to set up grand expectations that are discouraging. I mean, you talk to people who are around death a lot, and they'll tell you, like John did, that even when you're around it a lot, death continues to be a mystery. We don't run the show. I personally like the metaphor of death being a lot like birth. It's a natural process that's going to happen no matter what you do. But there are a few things you can think about in advance that can help reduce anxiety. Just like expectant mothers take a class to know what to expect, you can learn about dying so you have a better idea of what to expect. Expectant mothers make a plan that lets people know their ideal scenario, be at home or in the hospital, a team of people around, or lots of privacy. All the medical interventions available, or as little as possible. These are things to think about when you think about your ideal scenario for dying, too. You can have some things in place, like knowing how it's going to be paid for. You can line up people to do certain jobs. You can do practices to be sure your head and your heart are in a good place, no matter when it happens. And then you go with the flow. And everyone does their best, and nature and grace take over, and it is what it is. Before we finish up tonight, I want to leave you with a suggestion for your exit plan. In my mind, the exit plan is all those little things you do to prepare for your death and or the death of your loved ones. We often put these things on the back burner, but tonight, I hope you will commit to doing one thing in the near future to better prepare for your death. Earlier, I mentioned the book Living Fully, Dying Well by Edward Bastian and Tina Staley. This book is beautiful because it includes conversations with several different spiritual leaders and medical healers who each share insights about ways to transform death from a source of fear into an opportunity for experiencing the richness of living. The second half of the book offers exercises and practices so that you can begin your exploration of the mysteries of death as a way to live more fully the life you have left to live. These can also be done with a partner or other loved ones so that you gain a shared understanding of these things. The exercises include things like a life review. Doing a life review can help you appreciate all you have had and enjoyed and the strength you've gained from burdens you've had to bear. And it's a great gift to the next generation. There are simple exercises to help you tap into your inner source of wisdom, like John has, and for examining your ideas and beliefs about death. There are also exercises for healing emotional wounds and forgiveness, and this is a big one. Many of us carry around unresolved hurts. Many families have unresolved issues, and I've seen those hurts become even more painful when someone dies. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, my family has a story of this. A story of the family black sheep, my Uncle George, who'd been banished from the family by my grandfather because of his bad behavior. More than 30 years went by, and my grandmother and grandfather did not speak to their son. I remember from my childhood the very rare phone call, usually late at night, Christmas time, when George would call my dad, his brother. But I never met him. My grandmother never stopped missing her oldest son. And finally, she convinced my grandpa that they needed to heal this hurt before they died. I think they were in their 80s when a reunion was planned for the five family members. You should see the smiles in the photos. I was not there, but I know that it was a very important healing moment for all of my dad's family. That meeting didn't change the hurtful things that had happened or make up for all the years that were lost, but it did allow for some forgiveness and healing to occur. My Uncle George died not long after that, so it was good they did not wait too late. So I ask you, are there emotional wounds in your family that might be healed now, before it's too late? The book Living Fully, Dying Well also has practices for transforming pain and suffering. Transforming pain through shifting our awareness is a powerful practice that can help us throughout our life, but it can also be very helpful at the time of death. Millions of Americans live with chronic pain, and there are a growing number of studies and pain clinics using non-pharmaceutical interventions like meditation to address the problem. A Wake Forest University study showed an approximately 40% reduction in pain intensity ratings during meditation when compared with non-meditation. And the exciting thing is that the study showed it can work for beginners. One of the things that people say they fear the most about death is a painful death. Learning meditation exercises to manage pain is a proactive step you can do now for your exit plan. Lastly, a practice for caregivers living with those who are suffering, which could include pretty much all of us, really, is the simple breathing practice that in this book is called giving and receiving. It's based on a Tibetan Buddhist practice. There are several versions of this kind of breath work for dying and for living. You might want to start with a loving kindness meditation or a compassion meditation. There are YouTube videos and instructions for these available online. I have them at the Cancer Center Library and books that you can check out. What's wonderful about these simple breathing meditations is that you get this kind of healing and can give this kind of healing for free. No appointments, no co-pays, easy peasy. These are the kinds of things we're talking about when we say there are things you can do to prepare for the end of life. These are ways you can begin to explore the mysteries of living and dying. We're almost out of time. Let me announce a few things before we say goodbye. If you have been curious about Death Cafe and wondered what it's about, go to deathcafe.org, because due to COVID, there are now death cafes from all over the world available to you online. Go to deathcafe.org to learn more about Death Cafe and find one that fits into your schedule. Closer to home, the Chico Arts Center's open and hosting an exhibit apropos of Day of the Dead and All Souls Day called The Art of Remembrance, happening November 7th through December 13th, but I think the drop-off day is the 31st of October. And so you are invited to bring an ofrenda or offering for the community offer. This is something to entice the spirit of a loved one back for a visit. Your offering can be a photo, poem, note, flowers, sweet treat, miniature beverage, or something that the special person loved or shared with you. For more details, go to chicoartscenter.com. Okay, friends, do you have stories you'd like to share, topics you'd like covered, questions you want answered? Post them at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook or email me at thewheelmysteries@gmail.com. You can also listen to past shows by digging through past events on my Facebook page. And I want to thank John Schmidt again for being my guest. As for all of you, please share your stories, express your wishes, write them down, and remember, friends, talking about death won't kill you.
Just a perfect